Okay, this is still the 13th of November. We've decided to do a second tape on Mike Levine. He said he has the time. So this is still Mary Harrison and Mike Levine and Gabby Dinman. And Mike, you were talking about the staff at the Sun
Telegraph. Yeah, we had what I now believe to be a really terrific team of journalists. We in City Hall, the Sun Telegraph had a reporter named Joseph Patrick Brown. Good reporter. The police beat reporter was Dave Welty, who later became the press secretary to the mayor, and just recently retired. I covered the county beat. There was an interesting guy named Frank Schenkel covered the Common Pleas Court. Frank Schenkel was an unusual man. He was a religious person, and butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. He never swore, always wore a tie, jacket, coat. But in addition to his work covering criminal court, he was also the publicity man for the Casino Burlesque Theater. And he knew all the striptease dancers and always had interesting stories to tell about the performers there. But we had a really terrific team of reporters on the Sun Telegraph. We had a good newspaper then. It's ultra-conservative political policies. The Hearst political views didn't cut it in Pittsburgh, and the newspaper eventually, it just didn't relate to the people in Pittsburgh, so the newspaper failed. I left the newspaper about a year before it collapsed. I was offered a job back in broadcasting for KDKA. But while I was with the Sun Telegraph, I learned a lot. I had a marvelous city editor named Alex Zahner. His assistant was a guy named Byron Campbell. Alex Zahner's now dead. Byron Campbell has recently retired as a public relations man for Alcoa. And they were mean and petty and tyrannical and wonderful. They were demanding, they were exacting, they were stern, they were tough, they were rotten, they were everything that the city editors are supposed to be in the tradition of the business. And I love them. They were great. They taught me a lot about veracity and spelling and important things like composition and short sentences and short paragraphs. And they taught me a lot. And my colleagues on the Sun Telegraph were fabulous newsmen. And it was a great work experience for me.
When did it end?
Well, I was offered a $10 a week raise in pay if I would leave the Sun Telegraph and go to work for KDKA. KDKA was then leaving the NBC Blue Network.
What year was this?
It was 1956, I believe, around there. I think that's... a guy named Jim Snyder, who is now vice president for Time Life Communications radio and television stations in Washington, was then the news director in Pittsburgh of KDKA, and knew that I had had previous experience covering radio news in McKeesport, and I knew how to use a tape recorder and to edit tape and to put news on the air. And they needed an outside reporter to cover news. And they had a crazy idea about they were going to give me a car, and I was going to just do nothing but cover news and to cover stories with this radio newsroom on wheels. It took a long time before we eventually got the vehicle and got it equipped, but I joined KDKA because they offered to pay me $10 a week, more than the Sun Telegraph would pay me. The Sun Telegraph was paying then. I was a journeyman, I was a member of the newspaper guild, and I was getting the top scale. And the Sun Telegraph did not want me to leave, to go to the radio station. And they offered a counterproposal. They would give me $5 a week more if I would stay in newspaper work, because everybody knew at that time that radio was doomed to failure. And newspapers represented solid security for the future. Ha, ha. About a year after I left, they gave me a plaque when I left and said, "So long, knight on a dead horse." They thought becoming a newsman in radio would be the key to oblivion, and that the only real journalists were those working in the newspaper field.
How do you feel about telling us about what the salary was, or would you rather not?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't really know.
Okay.
Salary was not important to me in those days. I just really didn't give a damn. I gave some money to my parents, of course, but...
You were still living there.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... My parents became very proud of me, and my mother, for a long time, was clipping every story that I wrote, every byline that I ever got, and then when I went into broadcasting, they would hear me on the air every once in a while. And they thought that was... Well, KDKA was very big in the community in those days.
At what point, then, did you get married?
I married during the last year that I was in the newspaper. I was a newspaper man when I married Bernice.
And what was Bernice's maiden name?
Bernice Rosenberg lived in Squirrel Hill. I lived in the South Hills, and there were like oil and water. Two different social scenes. Jewish boys from South Hills didn't date Jewish girls from Squirrel Hill because they were all Japs, you know, the bit. Snobby and like that. I met this marvelous girl who had a good head on her shoulders and wasn't snobby, and she was beautiful. She had a body that wouldn't quit, and she seemed to like me, and we got along real well. It was good chemistry.
How old were you two when you got married?
About seven or eight.
So what year was it that you got married?
I'm assuming 56, 56? 55.
Yeah, 56. We just had our 40th anniversary.
Yeah.
You figure it out.
50.
Yeah, it was...
1950.
Yeah, it was just before I left the Sun Telegraph. I worked for a long time.
1950. 51. 40. Right? 1951?
Yeah, it would be 1951, September of 1951.
So if you left the Sun Telegraph in 55, that's wrong.
So right? I left the Sun Telegraph in 56, I think. In any event, I was okay. A working newspaper man.
Okay.
On the courthouse beat, and Bernice was then working for a plumbing supply house on the Boulevard of the Allies in Oakland. And we used to drive to work together in the morning. Yeah, oh boy, she's terrible in the morning. But I used to park my car at the county morgue. The morgue was on my beat. As a matter of fact, when I started on the county beat, the morgue, it was a different morgue in those days. It had a chapel in which embalmed bodies were laid out on display. We had a lot of homeless people in those days too, but nobody pitied them. But the coroner had to bury them as paupers, but he was required by law to hold the bodies for a certain period of time, hoping that they would be identified and they would be named and they would not die buried they would not be buried in anonymous graves. But the bodies were on display in a sort of icebox, believe it or not, in glass display cases, and kids would, after the senior prom, would go to the morgue to see the bodies. You did, Mary. Okay. Well, I worked there. I parked my car in the backyard. Dr. McClellan, the county coroner, was a neat guy, and befriended me. And I hung out at the morgue, and we would get our first tip of crime stories, murders, and suicides, and the violent death of all sorts. The first break would come at the county morgue. And I was a kind of a fancy Dan reporter for the Sun Telegraph then, because we always had tried to have a crime story on the front page of the Sunday paper. Now, the Sunday paper was the big issue for the Sun-Telegraph then. And the city editor would give me a pat on the head, sort of a reward or some kind of honor, if I could use the word bedroom and murder in the same lead sentence in the story. That was the kind of a newsman I was. I could spice up some of the old battle axe women who were murdered by their wino common law husbands. I would romanticize the story and splash it on the front page, and it would be a bedroom murder. And
like what?
I put it on the front page as though it was a lover's romance that ended in homicide, and that sort of thing. But we tried to have, I had Wednesdays off and worked Saturday, writing and covering news. On Saturday I covered the, what they called the waterfront. I would be one man covering the county beat, city hall, the police beat, whatever court cases, occasionally they would have a trial on Saturdays in criminal court, common pleas court, the federal court. And the federal beat reporter, I got to be known in every governmental office in the city of Pittsburgh at every level of government because I was the Saturday newsman on the waterfront. I can't believe it now. I used to walk on foot from the federal building to city hall to the courthouse. Occasionally, the Liquor Control Board would have hearings in the old Wabash building, which is now down where Gateway Center is. And I covered all of this stuff on foot. I ran my buns off on Saturday, and the front page, of course, would be mine. On Sunday, there would be a Mike Levine byline. Ta-da! But I parked the car at the county morgue, and Bernice and I would drive. I would drop her off, and she would meet me after work. I would pick her up on the way home, or she would get a ride home, and I would... But even after we had children, she would come bring the children and meet me at the county morgue. My kids were infants in the county morgue, and the county employees got to know them. One of the political workers in the county courthouse who was Jewish and encouraged me to marry the girl, that she, I showed her pictures, because... And even to this day, remembers that I referred to my wife as a Zeiskite, was this lady stenographer, secretary, assistant to the county clerk, urged me to marry the girl and get it over with. That lady has gone through the political system up into the office of the mayor of the city of Pittsburgh today. And Sophie Maslow likes to think that she made us get married. And but she remembers Bernice, she remembers my kids. I used to take my kids when there was a parade on Saturday. Saturday's a big day for parades in Pittsburgh, and we would take the kids to the county courthouse. Boy, am I babbling?
No, you're not babbling at all.
Take my kids down to the county courthouse, and we would go into the commissioner's office to look out the window and watch the parade. And Sophie Maslow would occasionally hold my kids on her lap. And so she got to know my kids when they were little, well, a couple of them anyhow. And but she knew Bernice, and she was kind of, she's been a friend of ours for, 40 years. That's how, well, I've known the mayor longer than I've known my wife.
I'd like to ask you something, Mike, because homelessness is an issue in our world today. How you mentioned that there were, you know, homelessness that's always occurred. Is there any difference then today? I mean, we are more people, so you have more homeless, but proportionately, do you think there are more homeless?
Because people
today
would be offended if I say that the society is more compassionate today. But relatively speaking, in those days, nobody cared at all.
And where were the homeless?
Where were they? They were all over the city of Pittsburgh. Do you remember the B&O railroad station?
Yes.
Well, the B&O railroad station was on the riverbank, and the station was, and its passenger and freight platforms were elevated on steel pillars. So that under the B&O railroad station, there would sometimes be dozens of homeless people living out of the rain, out of the weather.
So relatively speaking, you don't think there are more homeless today than there were then?
Well, it's a kind of a fluctuating sort of a thing. During the Depression era, my father tells me that the riverbank under the B&O had dozens and dozens of homes made out of cardboard cartons, canvas tents, and people, whole families were sleeping there then. And that was when the, what was it, Coxey's Army marched on Washington, demanding a bonus for veterans, so because they needed the money to live on. I suppose during the boom period, when the mills were running full blast, there were less homeless. But when I was on the beat in McKeesport, the word would go out from the county courthouse that it was harvest time. The county workhouse had orchards and fields, and they had huge crops, and at harvest time they would need a lot of workers. And the word would go out to the members of the minor judiciary. There was a magistrate in every ward in the city of Pittsburgh, and in the major third-class cities, McKeesport, Clareton, Duquesne, there were magistrates. The word would go out that they needed workers at the county workhouse. Send the winos. And the police would scoop up the homeless and arrest them. And they would appear, usually on charges of vagrancy or alcohol, wine, being drunk and disorderly. Trumped up charges. And not necessarily offended, some of these vagrants would be sent off to the county workhouse to be dried out, to be fed and clothed, and have three hots and a cot. Three hot meals and a bed to sleep in, and they would work in the county workhouse. The warden of the workhouse later boasted to me, when I was became a reporter on the county beat, about the weight gain. That every prisoner, the average prisoner, would gain 30 pounds in 30 days. But they would switch from a diet of wine and bread to bread and potatoes, and they put on starches like you wouldn't believe, but they would in fact gain. But there were dozens of people sent to the workhouse, men and women, to the county workhouse at times when they were needed. So there was no problem about finding homeless in the city of Pittsburgh. One of the major news stories that preceded me involved a Christmas breakfast served by the Little Sisters of the Poor. I did not cover the story, but as a reporter in the morgue, I learned about it as one of the huge tragedies of the city of Pittsburgh. You'd never hear about it to this day. But in the business, we knew that it was one of the worst tragedies that ever befell the city of Pittsburgh, when at the Little Sisters of the Poor, one of the chefs, one of the cooks, took a box of rat poison and mixed it in with the pancakes, so that dozens of these people were fed this breakfast on Christmas morning, and then fanned out across the city of Pittsburgh and collapsed and died. All over the city of Pittsburgh, there were dozens of deaths, I believe, of homeless people.
And what were the Little Sisters?
The Little Sisters of the Poor were out in Lawrenceville somewhere, I believe, out in the Bloomfield, I believe. But the homeless people knew that they could get food. They were giving them meals.
Did they find out about them? Was the chef ever prosecuted, or was all kept?
Oh, yeah. No. The morgue, of course, the morgue wagon was calling, dragging people in from the hospitals. But in those days, there were no medics. Emergency medical treatment was to throw people in the back of a paddy wagon, the same wagons that they used to. They don't have paddy wagons today. When I was a rookie, they did. It would be a patrol wagon that had two benches in the back, and they would arrest dozens of people sometimes. But one of the functions of the paddy wagon would be not only to take arrested prisoners from the scene of their arrest to the police station, to the jail, they also, if you were in a wreck, an automobile wreck, they would take you from the wreck in the back of a paddy wagon, lay you on the floor or on a stretcher in the back of the paddy wagon, and take you to a hospital. The paddy wagons were running all over at the time of the pancake breakfast of Sisters of the Poor, schlepping these poor people who were you can imagine what violent deaths they died.
And the chef was prosecuted.
Yeah, yeah.
And how was it kept quiet, or?
No, but because it happened to affect homeless people, I don't suppose it amounted to a whole hell of a lot. But there were many more people sickened than there were people who died. But in the city of Pittsburgh, the custom then was to take somebody from wherever they were, the scene of the accident or wherever they were stricken. If you had a heart attack, they would take you from your home to the nearest hospital. Standard treatment being, if you had a heart attack, they would put an oxygen mask on your face. That was sophisticated medicine in those days. But anyhow, we got on that subject of the pancake breakfast because of the homeless. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of homeless people then when I was a rookie reporter. And then for a long time, we just didn't pay attention to them. And today, we're concerned about them because in our society, it's ridiculous to think that there are people who are undernourished, malnourished, or without roofs over their heads. And people are becoming knowledgeable about the homeless. But anyhow, don't let me sermonize.
I want to also ask you now a little bit about your home life, your own immediate family home life, you, Bernice, and your three children. Religious influence, just give us sort of the atmosphere of your family life, where you started out, where you first lived, your first apartment or your first house. I think you mentioned an apartment. And then just sort of
there was always a religious factor in our lives. We were never devout. And I think a clergyman would be offended if they heard me say that we were casually religious. But
did you join a synagogue?
Yes, we did.
Where did you live?
Bernice and I went to services and went to high holiday observance with my parents. We lived in the South Hills. Her parents were in the East End section of Pittsburgh. And they attended Orthodox services, and we went to the Reform Temple Emmanuel. And we liked it. And when our children were old enough, they went to Sunday school.
So you moved to the South Hills with Bernice, is that correct?
Yes. Okay. Yes. We were first married. We had an apartment in Prospect Park. We had a little efficiency apartment for our first year or so of marriage. And then we rented an apartment with a second bedroom when we had the baby at Cloverleaf Village. And we lived there for a few years. And then bought a house in Greentree. Actually, it was Scott Township off Greentree Road. Our first house was a three-bedroom. By then, we had three kids. And they went to Sunday school, and they attended, they got religious training. And the boys were bar mitzvahed. Mark, the youngest, had a bar mitzvah at Temple Emmanuel. Let me correct that. Jeffrey had a bar mitzvah at Temple Emmanuel. Then there was a period, and you're going to ask me when, and I don't remember the year, but Westinghouse moved me to a sister station in New York City. I became a reporter, an outside street reporter, for radio station WINS, which is today still a very prominent all-news operation in New York City. And while there, we lived in a house we bought in Teaneck, New Jersey. And Mark had his bar mitzvah there. All three kids went to Sunday school and were friendly with Jewish kids. The Jewish influence in their life was mostly at home, though. We always had Jewish recipes on the table, Jewish foods on the table. Bernice always lit Friday night the Shabbos candles. The children, while they're out of town, still attend, go to Jewish services, but it's not a major influence in their lives. Not major. Jeffrey married a Gentile girl. Debbie is still single, but she, and all three children go to Jewish services at the, on the high holidays. Mark did marry a Jewish girl quite recently, about a year ago, less than a year ago. So,
and your grandchildren are being raised as Jews or Gentiles or both or?
A little of both. I just really don't know how to describe it. In Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Jeffrey, the oldest son, was not comfortable with the only Jewish congregation there. He found them to be cold, unfriendly, and somewhat materialistic. And like most kids of his generation, or at least in his circle of friends, he's idealistic, and he is a marvelously down-to-earth kid. He has his PhD, but he's still very very much a plain person. He didn't establish a rapport with the people of the Jewish community there, and but religion is an influence in their life, and consequently they are in the Unitarian group. But in a sense, the Unitarians acknowledge Jewish influence in their religion and in their lives. My grandsons were not named in a Jewish service here or there. This is a matter of some anguish that's not pleasant for me to talk about.
Okay.
My wife is upset by the fact that the children were not named. They were named in the Jewish tradition in honor of members of the family, but they were not given the Jewish naming ceremony. And Bernice is upset about that.
Okay.
Debbie, we're still waiting for Debbie to meet a Jewish boy, and she's very cognizant of the fact that she wants to be a Jewish wife for a Jewish husband, and we're hoping that that'll happen. She lived and worked in the Orient for 5 years, and she wasn't meeting too many Anglo-Saxon men of any kind. But she's now back in this country. She's an expert in Chinese. She graduated summa cum laude from Hunter College in New York. And she went to the Orient and worked for a number of financial houses there. And she's now in Los Angeles. And she goes to services there at a nearby temple. Wilshire Boulevard Temple is a huge yuppie synagogue in Los Angeles, but Debbie happens to live just a couple of blocks away from it. Mark married a young lady named Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N, but in Pittsburgh that name is pronounced Kaufman. In New York it's Kaufman, and she's Jewish. And we like that, they're observant in a casual sort of way, like us.
Okay, Mike, let's go back now to, you're now in New York, you're with Westinghouse, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. What are you doing for Westinghouse in New York?
Well, there was a period in American history, I don't suppose it'll be an epic in the history books, but there was a period during the Vietnam War when there were demonstrations on campuses, and I covered about 8 campus riots. Not demonstrations, riots, spelled R-I-O-T-S. There was the anti-war movement was becoming so vocal and so pronounced, and then the young people of that generation were so avid in their opposition to the war that there were riots. I covered 8 of them.
Which one?
Well, the big one, of course, the one that most people remember was the big demonstration, anti-war demonstration on the campus in Columbia. That was one of the stories that I covered. News in New York City is like the city itself, somewhat bigger than life. There were great big fires with tremendous loss of life. I covered news out on the street. I interviewed famous people and covered big news stories there. I covered City Hall. John Lindsay was the mayor we loathed and despised one another from an argument that developed my first day in the city.
Which was what?
Well, I threatened to quit Westinghouse because I was working here in Pittsburgh as a newsman in the morning and afternoons, and I was doing the talk show and the magazine show at night, and my home life was suffering. I was suffering. I was working my tail off. I was making a lot of money. But I was working so hard that I wanted to quit. I was just tired. I mean, dead tired. And Bernice was upset because I was ignoring the home and ignoring the kids, and the kids were a little bit embarrassed by the circus wagon that I was running around with. Maybe you've seen the mobile unit with the huge call letters of the radio station on the side. So, in those days, headquarters for the Westinghouse Broadcasting Company was on Park Avenue in New York City, and I was well known enough in the company that I was kind of the dimpled darling of the president of the company, and a couple of the vice presidents there knew me. And
who were they?
Don McGannon was the head of Westinghouse Broadcasting.